The nominees for Outstanding Achievement in Film Editing are Michael Kahn for Close Encounters of the Third Kind,
Walter March for Julia,
Walter Hanneman and Angelo Ross for Smokey and the Bandit,
Paul Hirsch, Marcia Lucas and Richard Chu for Star Wars,
William Reynolds for The Turning Point.
And the winner, Miss Fawcett, is...
Okay. The winners are Paul Hirsch, Marcia Lucas, and Richard Chu for Star Wars.
You've taken your first step into a larger world. Let's go.
Hello there. I'm Rowan Williams.
I'm Baz McAllister.
And welcome to Force Material, the show that's all about the secrets and source material of Star Wars. This week, our guest is a bona fide legend of the film editing world. He's worked with iconic directors like George Lucas, Brian De Palma, George A. Romero, Irvin Kershner, John Hughes, Herbert Ross, and more recently, Brad Bird and Duncan Jones. He won an Oscar for his work on just his sixth film 43 years ago, a little movie you might have heard of called Star Wars. And since then, he's been nominated for another Academy Award and has worked on dozens more films in an enviable career lasting five decades and counting, which he's recounted in his recent memoir, A Long Time Ago in a Cutting Room Far, Far Away. He is, of course, Paul Hirsch. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, Paul, we sort of understand your way into the movie business was, itself an oft-used movie trope. You started in the mailroom and worked your way up.
I got a job as a gopher at a small industrial film company in Manhattan. And during my first weeks there, I met a negative cutter who was looking for someone to train. So after 2 weeks, I gave 2 weeks' notice, and I went to work for this negative cutter. And I worked for him for about 6 months. I learned the whole technical end of the business and how to prepare negative for printing and the importance of losing a frame when you make a splice. In 16 millimeter, you have to lose three frames. But after 6 months, I stopped learning and it started to become really difficult, boring business. It's a combination of having to pay strict attention to something that's extremely boring. So you can't make mistakes. And anyway, I left there and I got a job subsequent to that as an assistant editor at a trailer house. And they were getting a lot of business and they couldn't handle all that they were doing. They started feeding me little projects to do. And after a short time, what happened was I started doing the work and I realized that I enjoyed it and that I had a knack for it. So the client liked what I did and they started giving me more work and that was it. I was a trailer editor. And my brother Charles was working at Universal Pictures in New York at the time. He was a very good talker. He talked his way into a job as a junior executive screening, directing, and writing talent. And he had met this young filmmaker who was looking for money from Universal to make a film. They turned them down. So my brother and this young filmmaker, Brian De Palma, decided to shoot a picture on their own, which they did. And then they needed a trailer for it. So they came to me, which is how I met Brian. And then Brian and I hit it off. We had both been to Columbia University and our senses of humor jibed and he liked my work and they got the money to do a sequel to Greetings, originally titled Son of Greetings. They changed the title eventually to Hi Mom. And that was my first picture. I was 23 years old. I didn't know that I didn't know anything. I went into it with the confidence of total ignorance. And I thought, cut a feature? Yeah, I can do that.
Yeah,
no problem. Yeah, I can do that.
Yeah, it was back in the days when no one could tell you no. No one knew what they were doing anyway, right?
Well, this is kind of, the way it is in the business. You fake it till you make it, right?
It's yeah.
That was operating on that principle before I knew it was a principle.
Mm. I believe your dad was a painter and your mom was a dancer. And they're both sort of artistic pursuits that require a great degree of attention to detail and technical knowledge. Was that your upbringing, or were you raised with an artistic upbringing in that household?
Yeah, there was a lot of interest in the arts and politics. And I think it was inevitable that I would wind up in something related to the arts. My mother had a strong influence on me, and she had sort of urged me to attend a public high school in New York called the High School of Music and Art. Music and art, there were several specialized schools in the public school system in New York. Bronx High School of Science and Stuyvesant were geared toward the sciences, and music and art was geared toward music and art. So, but it also gave, you know, it also got a lot of its graduates into good colleges. So it was the equivalent of a very good private school, and you had to take a test to get in. So I was a music student there for 3 years, and then I went to Columbia University. And I had studied music in high school, and then when I got to Columbia, I had some great teachers in art history, and I decided to major in art history. At the end of which, I decided I wanted to. This is during the Vietnam War, so there was a lot of pressure to stay in school, because if you were in school, you'd get a deferment. You wouldn't have to be shipped off to the jungles of Southeast Asia. And in fact, Greetings, the picture that Brian De Palma and my brother made, was all about three young guys trying to avoid the draft, one of whom was Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
But anyway, at the time, in 1966, at Columbia, most guys went to either law school or medical school after college, if they went on in school. And that wasn't going to work for me. And then there was also business school, but that also wasn't going to work for me. So I applied to architecture school, and I got in. And I was very interested in architecture. And I didn't have quite enough credits to graduate. So I had to take a summer school program. And I heard on the last day, I heard about a program in Paris. So I ran over to the French department and I applied and I got in, and I was able to go to summer school in Paris the year after I was to have graduated. I actually got my degree in the fall with the points I got that summer. But while I was in Paris, I was exposed to all these French art theaters that were showing Hollywood movies as art.
Mm-hmm.
And I would see marquees with directors' names on them, which is something I'd never seen in the States. You know, you'd go see a Kirk Douglas movie. You didn't go see a Raoul Walsh movie. You know, it was a whole different attitude toward film. And I started to think about films as art in a way I never had before. And the Cinematheque over there had a series of films dedicated. They had a Orson Welles festival in 1 week. So on Monday, I went to see Citizen Kane, a picture I knew the title, but that was all I knew about it, which was the best way to see the movie, not to have heard anything about it at all. And I was just floored by it. So the next day, I came back and saw The Magnificent Ambersons. Then Wednesday, they showed Lady from Shanghai. And Thursday was Touch of Evil. And then Friday, Wells was going to appear in person. You couldn't get near the place. So those films made a lasting impression on me, although it was sort of, you know, subliminal. I didn't realize, but they excited me in a way that architecture didn't. So I came back to New York in the fall, and I started school, and I realized that this was not going to work for me. It was too dry and academic and quiet. And I needed something with a little more juice to it. And I saw a Moviola for the first time, which sort of, you know, rocked my world. And that's when I sort of aimed for getting into the business, which I did.
Mm.
So
was there a particular film that sort of made you you know, consciously aware of what was possible with film editing? Like, that was a real sort of moment of epiphany for you?
Well, there were many, I'd say, but I think one film that had a particularly powerful influence on me, I was already an editor at this point, but in 1971, The French Connection came out and was edited by a New York editor, a guy named Jerry Greenberg, with whom I became friends ultimately. Jerry was the first editor in New York ever to win an Oscar. And that picture was, you know, it's just a knockout. It's just extraordinary. But there were a number of pictures along the way, like Bonnie and Clyde, the famous shootout at the end of Bonnie and Clyde. And there was a picture called The Knack by Richard Lester, which does some extraordinary things editorially. And you know, it wasn't a single one, but there were many pictures that excited me in that way and sort of gave me the perspective of editing as an art form. I mean, I met a lot of guys, and when I came to Hollywood, it was interesting because I had gotten into editing as an, you know, because I was interested in film as an art. And I got to Hollywood and I met these guys who were really great editors. But they got into the business because they were pumping gas and their uncle had a connection to somebody at the studio, got him a job in the shipping department, you know, and he started out in the shipping department. And then the post-production people would look for apprentices among their own employees. So they'd pick somebody from the shipping department to make him an assistant, an apprentice, and then they'd work their way up. And after 8 years, they get to be an editor. And you didn't have to have studied, you know, in film school to become an editor. That, you know, they sort of got to it in a way that I never would have dreamed of myself. But they turned out to be really good editors too. They're not particularly educated men or women, but they're really good at it, you know.
Your first five films are all with Brian De Palma, who, you know, so he was sort of becoming this legendary film director at the same time as, you know, you were learning your craft. I mean, what was that time like? Did you feel like you were sort of learning new things with every project? Were you guys sort of feeding each other's creativity? Like, what was that relationship like?
Well, I tell people that my relationship with Brian was like a film running in reverse. We started out as almost brothers, and then we became friends, then we became colleagues, then we became acquaintances, and now we're strangers. So, no, in those days, you know, when you're young and working alongside people regularly, it's a real strong bond. He gave me a lot of, he put a lot of confidence in me. He empowered me. He encouraged me. He gave me a lot of opportunity, and he was great. But, you know, it was difficult at first because there were 2 years, I think, between my first film and my second film. Another 2 years went by, and then he started doing them once a year, so that made things easier. But I had to fill in the gaps to support myself, you know, cutting commercials and stuff like that. But yeah, Brian was learning his craft the same time I was, and I remember one time he was feeling rather bullish, and he said to me, "Kid, I'm going to the top, and I'm taking you with me." And I said, and I, feeling equally bullish, said, "Who's taking who?" So, but we had a great time, and it, you know, he was very inclusive socially. He invited me to meet his friends, and you know, he was friends with Spielberg and Scorsese, and I didn't know George Lucas at the time, but when, you know, when I got to the West Coast is when I first met him. But Spielberg used to come to New York and visit the editing room all the time. And it was a small group of a cohort of guys who were about the same age and women. It was a small community and we knew each other.
And was that the reason then how you got approached to work on A New Hope, because those guys all knew each other?
The way that worked out was, well, when I did Phantom of the Paradise, I flew out to California for a screening on the Fox lot, and I was introduced to George and Marshall Lucas for the first time. And Marcia was very enthusiastic, and she said, "Oh, we love the editing. You got to meet George." She dragged me over, and I met George, and that was that. So about a year later, or maybe less than a year, Marcia was cutting Taxi Driver for Scorsese, and she called me up in New York, and she said, "Listen, we need help cutting the picture. There's a lot, you know, Marty's been shooting a lot of footage, and we need help. Can you come work on the picture?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to." She said, "Because you work with Bernard Herrmann, and that would, you know, that would help too." And I said, "Yeah, yeah, I'd love to." So she called back the next day. She said, "Oh, I'm sorry, the studio, we pitched you to the studio, and they turned you down because they said they didn't want to pay for, you know, transportation expenses for somebody to come from New York." So I said, "Well, that's that went by." And then I was cutting. George was casting Star Wars, and Brian was casting Carrie, and they were looking for the same age actors. So they had the casting sessions together. And during a break in one of their sessions, Brian called up and he put George on the phone with me. And George said, "Listen, you know, I really like your work, and I'd love to work with you someday. I have an editor for this next picture I'm doing, but, you know, I'll be doing another one after that. Maybe you can do that one." And I said, "Great." You know, and after I got off the phone, I thought, "Well, too bad it's not this one."
Mm.
And I started work on Carrie, and George went off to England and was shooting Star Wars. And in New York, we had another mutual friend named Jay Cox. Jay was married to an actress named Verna Bloom, who was in Haskell Wexler's picture Medium Cool. She was the woman in the yellow dress.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, we were over Jay and Verna's house, and Jay had been to England and had visited the set of Star Wars and had come back with a book of production stills. And I looked at these stills, and they just knocked me out. They had, you know, they were black and white stills, but there was the sand crawler and the Jawas and various droids and the stormtroopers and Vader and the Wookiee, and just stunning images that we all are now very familiar with. But, you know, back then it was brand new and never before seen. Mm. I went home that night with my wife and I said, "You know, honey, I know George wants to work with me someday, but I really, really wish it would have, it could have been this one, because this picture looks fantastic." Then George and Marcia finished principal photography in London. They came back through New York on their way to California. And by that time, we had a cut of Carrie, and we showed them the picture. And a couple of weeks later, Marcia called up and invited me to come help out on Star Wars. She said, "We have to recut the whole, you know, the cut doesn't work. We have to start over, and we need help, and we're not going to make it without an extra pair of hands. Are you available?" So my wife was 1 month pregnant at the time, and I thought, I guess I should really check with her first, you know. So I told Marcia I'd get back to her. And then Brian overheard this. He said, "What?" And he picked up the phone. He called Marcia right back. He said, "He'll do it. This is what we're paying him. Can you afford that? Okay, it's done." You know? So he said to me, "Don't tell her your problems. Go home and, you know, work it out with Jane." You know, so I went home and I told Jane, you know, I'd been offered this job, this fantastic job, dream job, and she said, "Do it." So that's how I got to work on it.
And what was your first impression of actually seeing, you know, you'd seen stills and, but, you know, actually seeing footage and editing footage from this film? Because, I mean, this was sort of unlike anything that anyone had sort of seen before, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, when you're working on a movie, you're sort of playing this game, like, what's wrong with this picture? They used to have these in the newspaper that would have, you know, a picture and say, "What's wrong with this picture?"
Yeah.
And it'd be, you know, you say, "Well, the bicycle is on the roof, you know, the chicken has two heads," or, you know, whatever it is. You look for mistakes in the picture. When you're cutting a picture, you're sort of playing that game. You're looking at it and you're thinking, "What's wrong with this picture? Is it confusing? Is it too slow? You know, whatever the problems might be, you're sort of watching it open to these potential things. And in my situation, coming into it very late, with after the picture had already been cut once, it's a lot easier to see what's wrong because I haven't made those choices in the first place. Mm. So, you know, it's easier to look at and see what's wrong. It's also easier to have gotten it right in the first place. So I don't recommend it, you know. But, you know, when I first, I guess the first sequence I saw was the stormtroopers blasting their way onto the ship in Reel One.
Uh-huh.
I remember there was a cut to one of the soldiers, a big close-up. And I said, "Who's he?" And George said, "Well, that's the captain." I said, "Does he have a big part?" And he said, "No." So I thought, why are we cutting to a close-up of somebody who doesn't matter, you know? So that was the kind of thing that, you know, what's wrong with this picture is like, I need to give this kind of attention to a minor character. So, you know, it was, and then it was just, and what else? Then I saw the sequence where Leia puts the message into R2, the famous, you know, she puts it in, she looks around and anyway, so, yeah, it was off and running at that point. And then at no point did I ever sit down and watch the movie. There was no time.
Mm.
I mean, I went up there on a Saturday and I started working the day I got there. I had Sunday off for, you know, to get acclimated. I was living in a motel not too far from where we were working. And then Monday morning, we started in 6 days a week for 8 months, you know. So there was just work, work, work.
Even though the movie had already been cut, as you said before, I think still a lot of the special effects shots weren't finished at the time we were working. So how did you work around that?
There were no shots finished.
Mm.
Yeah. George was still building ILM. He was still, right. They were still putting together the equipment. Yeah. And they were doing tests and so forth. And the effect shots, well, the big sequence, of course, was the end battle. Mm-hmm. And Marcia was tasked with focusing only on that. So Richard Chu and I were devoted to recutting the reels. Marcia was working just only on the end battle and building it from the pieces that she had. And she had all the footage of the pilots in their cockpits. And she had the footage of Leia and her generals and so forth back at the control center or whatever with the you know transparent maps of things. And, you know, so what was missing was the exteriors of the ships. We didn't have any shots of those because that was all to be shot by ILM. So what Marcia was using in the meantime was black and white footage of aerial combat from the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
And every shot would have a number scribed in the corner of the first frame. So if you wanted to sort of decipher what was going on, you'd stop and you'd pull out the film, you look at the number on the first frame, and then you go to an enormous book and you'd find the shot 435J, 435K, 435K POV Vader's ship coming toward camera. And then you look at the shot and it would be two Japanese fighters veering off this way. It had nothing to do with coming toward camera, you know? So it was just a representation of an effects shot to come.
Mm.
And she was gauging the length, sort of guessing at the length, either guessing at or determining the length. So it was just a feeling of pacing within the context of the cutting of the dialogue and the you know, and then while she was doing that, the studio threatened to cut the sequence.
Mm.
The picture had gone over budget slightly and they had no confidence in the project. And they said to George, "Look, they've rescued the princess. That's it. The movie's over. You don't need an end battle."
Oh my God.
So So George was determined to have the end battle in the picture. So he wanted to get it in the works early so they couldn't cut it. Mm. Once they'd spent money on it, they were sort of committed. It was, you know, so that was the plan. So at a certain point, ILM said, we have to have the sequence now. We're ready to start production of our shots. And if you want to start on the end battle first, we need it, you know, a week from today or whatever it was. So George took me off what I was doing, and we broke the sequence in half. And Marcia took, it was a bit like two thirds. She took two thirds to herself, and they gave me the last third, which was the, you know, Luke's trench run. So I worked on that. She worked on the first two thirds. After a day or two, we put them together, and the three of us, George, Marcia, and I, sort of tag teamed, working on it for a couple of days. I would drive, and Marcia and George would sit in the couch behind me. And then after a couple of hours, I'd get up and sit with George, and Marcia would come up and she would drive. And then we locked the sequence after a couple of days and turned it over to ILM.
Mm. George Lucas was someone who, you know, he came from an editing background. Like, editing is kind of what made him fall in love with film in the first place. So he had that kind of like editor's sensibilities. Of course, you know, Marcia, as you said, was in there editing the film as well as Richard Chu. What was that working relationship like? Like, how hands-on was George in the editing room, and how involved was he with that process?
George was not hands-on at all. Actually, he was much too busy. He would fly to, we were up in the Bay Area, and he would fly to LA Monday morning, spend Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday with the guys at ILM. Wednesday night, he'd fly back north, and Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, he would come and look at the work that I had done, the work that Marcia had done, the work that Richard had done, and give us notes. And, you know, so he was just too busy to actually sit and edit anything.
Mm.
But he did tell me that the only reason he became a director was to have something to edit.
Yeah.
And the only reason he became a writer was to have something to direct. So you're right in that his first true love was editing. And there was some friends of his from LA staying at the property where we were working, the Parkway House, and they were partners, Hal Barwood and Matthew Robbins, and they were working together on a script for Matthew's debut as a director, and it was called Corvette Summer, and starred Mark Hamill.
Yeah,
and they were always around. They were, you know, in their office writing, and we'd see them at lunch every day. And Matthew said to me, he says, "Aren't you nervous?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, George's an editor himself, you know, and he already fired one editor." And I said, "No, I'm not." And I didn't feel nervous. I just felt busy. I was busy as hell. But George was, you know, he was preoccupied with everything else that was going on. I mean, if he would look at my sequence, you know, I'd show him a sequence, he'd say, "Great." You know, I'd want a little more, you know. It was not his way. He would just say, "Great.
Yeah.
Why don't you go on to this now, you know?" And so it was a very, you know, he was under a lot of pressure, and we were under a lot of time. I felt like we were under a lot of time pressure, not emotional pressure, just, you know, time pressure, because we had to get the job done, and it was a lot to do.
Mm.
We're working in film, you know, so to make changes, you have to take apart the splices, find the bits that, you know, attach to the pieces that are in, and it's time consuming, you know.
Mm. You really did get thrown into this whole process, as you said, and had to start working really quickly. Did George have time to kind of explain his vision for this thing to you, like space fantasy as opposed to sci-fi, and with all the tropes coming, you know, in from Westerns and samurai films and things like that? Did he kind of have time to go over his vision for it with you?
Well, we didn't get into those specifically. Some of those topics we did. I mean, Saturday mornings is when the pressure was off the most, because the phones from LA would stop ringing, and he would come into the editing room, and he could kind of relax a little. And we did have some nice long conversations about life and, you know, what it's like. I mean, I was from the East Coast, he was from the West Coast, and we were just comparing notes. And, you know, the young guys, I was 30. I think I turned 31 mm-hmm. when I was working on the picture. So, you know, and I had a baby on the way, and we're just comparing notes, you know, and in New York, all you care about is earning enough to pay the rent. And in California, it's all about paying the car payments and the insurance, you know, and the mortgage. So it's just a different, you know, just learning about each other. And he had been to film school and I hadn't. So he had studied certain principles, and he's a very analytical person, and he had broken down filmmaking to principles that he believed in and could articulate. And it was very interesting to me to hear him talk about these things, as I had never, you know, I was learning on the job and sort of, you know, reinventing the wheel. Which is very exciting. I mean, I felt like I invented editing in a way I had, because nobody taught me about it. You know, so he had certain ideas that were very, he was very committed to that, you know, one bad idea can ruin 10 good ideas. And one bad minute of film can ruin the next 10 minutes of film. And I write about this in my book in detail.
Yeah.
I put it down on paper when I could still remember. Now I've gotten to an age now where the memory is like, you know, I think memory is like you send a little messenger to get the file, you know.
Yeah.
And over the years there are a lot more files, and the messenger's gotten old and slow, you know? So you send somebody to get that file, and you know, the guy is making his way, and eventually they'll come back with the file, but it might be much later than you wanted it.
Were those sort of principles that George would talk about in conversation, like, were those things that you kind of took forward with you from there and you know, applied to the rest of your career?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I tried to learn from everybody I worked with. You know, Brian's whole outlook was all about point of view, POV shots. You know, he builds sequences based on, it's sort of like, you know, the parts of a sentence, the subject, the verb, the object. So it's like the actor, what he sees, and then how he reacts. So it puts you into the character's mind without the need for exposition or dialogue. And he's a very visual director, and he, you know, his whole approach is trying to achieve what he considers to be pure cinema, which is storytelling without without the crutch of dialogue. So I learned, you know, and then Kirshner, when I worked with Kirshner, he said to me, he held up a finger like this. He says, physical difficulty is boring. And I thought, he's got a point, you know? And yeah, I tried to, you know, since I didn't go to school, I have to learn from whomever I can, you know, so pick up things along the way.
And legend has it that George, at one point of editing style, was originally planned to make Luke's lightsaber red and Vader's lightsaber blue. And it was you that suggested switching colors. Why was that?
Yeah, well, that was because, you know, I had studied art history in college, and I had this great teacher who taught Italian Renaissance painting. And he pointed out that in the traditional Christian iconography, blue represented the celestial and red was the earthly. So I said, if you're going to have red and blue, you should really have, you know, the good guy, Luke, have the blue sword, and Vader should have the red sword. That's how that worked out.
Star Wars is famous for its use of transitional wipes. I haven't gone back and counted, but I've seen people listing like A New Hope having 31 and Empire having 42. And given that, you know, one of George's big influences, Kurosawa, used similar wipes in his films, was that like from the top down? You know, did George say, you got to use these wipes for me?
No. I mean, the first picture I did, My Mom, had wipes in it. I think you could only afford 5. But, but I always liked wipes because I always find that they're very useful in making a transition from one static shot to another. You have two shots that are static. And if you introduce movement in the transition in the form of a wipe, it helps. And, you know, when I got into the business, I would be delegated. When I was an assistant editor at this trailer house, I'd be delegated. And, of course, trailers use a lot of wipes. They used to. I'd be delegated to the optical house. And the optical house would have a sheet, an 8x11 sheet, showing all the different wipes they could do. They could go this way, they could go that way, they could go up, they could go down, they go this way, they go this way, this way, they go diagonal this way, diagonal the other way, you know, iris in, iris out, you know, then they had shapes and, you know, and so like they would have these displayed on this page. It was like somebody, one of the directors I worked with later called it the flags of all the nations. You know, they were like 50 or 80 different wipes they could do. And they were just fun, you know. I used them in Hi Mom, and I always had a sort of predilection for them. And then when I got to be working on Star Wars, it just seemed natural that this is a picture that was based on serials from the 30s when that was very much in vogue. And I said to George, you know, I said, you know, I think wipes would be great here. And I mean, I don't remember. He said it to me or I said it to him. You know, when you're working with somebody and ideas come up, at the end of the day, you can't remember whose idea it was. But it was, you know, it was sort of a natural, idea, whether it came from me or not, I can't really say, you know. But I had used them. You know, I wanted to make a big deal out of the wipes in Hi Mom, so I had them delay the incoming and the outgoing by a few frames. So there's a heavy black line that highlights, they did a star one, or I forget all the ones that I did in the picture, but I had this heavy black line to make a point of it, you know, because it was an effect and, you know, it was meant to call attention to itself. And I guess George may have seen that. And he said, but he says, they were hard lines. They were sharp focus. And he wanted the wipes to be soft focus. I remember that.
Showing a split second of Governor Tarkin, you know, Peter Cushing, immediately before the Death Star explodes was your idea as well. And it's something that, you know, other Star Wars movies have gone on to do with their sort of evil officer types. You know, we see in The Last Jedi, we see Captain Kennedy just before his ship explodes. Same thing in The Rise of Skywalker with General Pride. Why was it important to you to sort of show Tarkin, you know, in his moment of defeat?
Well, there were a number of things going on. One of which was, we simply needed time for Luke to get away before the, you know, in film time, he drops the torpedo and it goes in the shaft. And then you need time for him to get away from the ship, to get away from the Death Star before it explodes. And we had this shot of the ships racing away, but we needed, you know, and then without that shot, if you look at it, it's just there are no people involved. It's just spaceship and Death Star and Bond, you know, you have to introduce a human element into it to personalize or dramatize the moment so that you remember you're not only blowing up the Death Star, you're blowing up this evil guy who blew up a planet before. You know? So it was just, you know, sort of wanting to bring it back to a human dimension, and also to put kind of a button on the sequence, the last little flourish, you know, before the payoff. I just come from working with Carrie in the prom sequence when Carrie has the blood dumped on her. Nancy Allen is crouched under the stage, and there are various shots of her holding the rope and getting ready to yank the cord. And just before the rope, before the bucket tilts and the blood hits Carrie, I had done the same thing. I cut to Nancy's mouth. It's like a, you know, Sergio Leone type, huge, big close up of her mouth smiling, sort of evil grin. The same idea was to like put a little zinger, a little button before the climax, you know, so it's the last thing in your mind before it goes. And in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and in the parade sequence, there's a sequence where they're singing Twist and Shout and the crowd is going, ah, 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 and it's building up to that climax, you know. And at the end of that, I put a shot of a little kid holding his ears.
Yes.
He had done it spontaneously, but it was perfect because it was a little zinger at the end before I cut to the big wide shot, and it sort of expressed the volume that the crowd had reached, you know. The excitement had built to such a point. When we mixed it, there were limits on how loud you could go for the sound to be on this, on the optical track. And so you had to sort of reverse engineer it. So we're going to get this loud at that moment. We have to be lower than that so you can build up to it. So, and that was, you know, a concerted effort to get that moment, the kid in his ears, the maximum volume and the cut to the wide shot. And, you know, it's all part of your tools.
Yeah. So at any point in that process of, you know, of cutting this film together, and as you say, you know, playing, you know, What's Wrong with This Picture and being sort of caught up in the day-to-day minutiae of it, was there any point where you thought, hey, you know, I might be working on an Oscar winner here. This might be what gets me my Oscar. Or was that just did that just come out of left field?
Well, I got this job when I was still worried about getting work on feature films. I wasn't even dreaming of an Oscar. I mean, I was so young and I'd had so few films under my belt that I wasn't thinking Oscar, you know. I remember seeing an ad for the picture at Christmas time and it said a 6-track stereophonic sound and 70 millimeter. And I thought, I'm working on a picture. I couldn't believe it. You know, it was just, I've been working on 16 millimeter just a few years earlier. So, it never occurred to me. I mean, I was just too busy to think about those things. And I was also 31 years old. So I hadn't developed a hunger for it. And, I had no thought about it at all. And then, I came back to New York and Brian said to me, he says, you're going to win an Oscar. And it was the first time it occurred to me. I thought, oh, I guess I could, couldn't I? So, yeah, I mean, I have other friends, you know, I have editor friends, really great editors who never won. And I know that it can weigh on people, you know. I had a friend, Richie Marks, who cut, you know, you look up his credits, they're extraordinary. The Godfather 2 and Apocalypse Now and Terms of Endearment and all the James Brooks films and Dick Tracy with Warren Beatty. And he never won, you know. And good friend Billy Weber has fantastic credits and he hasn't won, but it's, you know, the award is a nice thing and I'm not giving it back or anything, but I think what's more important is the picture and what people remember are the pictures, not the awards.
Yeah.
You know, Alfred Nobel started giving awards because he was manufacturer of dynamite and he was trying to make himself more respectable. And it was this sort of by awarding people of great distinction, he in effect conferred distinction on himself. So that the award, you know, at a certain point, the recipients give greater honor to the award than the award gives to the recipient.
Yeah. You know?
So
the ultimate con.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, it's all publicity. And the Oscar, you know, the Academy is a publicity machine. That's what it is. It's a PR machine. And it makes me laugh sometimes when I see people talking about the awards as if they were kind of, you know, they were civil rights or something, you know.
Yeah.
Not fair. You know, it's just meant to drum up interest in the pictures. You know what I mean? It was the whole idea. Get people talking. And it worked, but it worked beyond their, you know, they went kind of too far. I mean, yes, it's not right that the movie business doesn't represent a more diverse world, the universe, you know, that the people watching the movies aren't always represented to the degree that they should be. But it's a difficult issue to control. I mean, I tried to hire throughout my career. I made an effort to hire people of color in the editing room, and I did. But there just aren't that many candidates around for those jobs. I think, you know, the world is changing now. This was years ago, and I'm sure there are a lot more people getting into the business than used to. But it's a new world. I'm part of an old world. I'm an immigrant in this new world.
So there was obviously the famous screening of Star Wars that everybody sort of heard of, where, you know, at one stage of the process, George invited some of his buddies, including, you know, your mutual friend Brian De Palma, to see an early cut. And Brian allegedly said something to the effect of, you know, look, George, I don't mean to sound harsh, but what is this shit? Were you sort of in the room for that? Like, what? When did you first sort of hear of that screening?
Yeah, well, it was not an early cut. It was kind of a late cut. It was in February, I think. The picture came out in June, so February is not that early a cut. I've been there since I'd been there since early October or late September, I think. So we've been working on it for quite a while by February rolled around. In fact, so George had this director screening and invited his director friends. Coppola was out of town. He was in the Philippines shooting Apocalypse. He saw it separately on a different occasion. But Steven Spielberg was there, and Scorsese had been invited, but he bowed out at the last minute, claiming his asthma had acted up. But I suspect that I had heard that he was afraid he wouldn't like the picture and he didn't want to embarrass himself for George. So he didn't come. But there was a lot of fog that day, and the planes were late coming from Los Angeles. And so Brian was there, and Steven, and Jay was there, Jay Cox, and Willard Hike and Gloria Katz, who had worked on the script and had worked with George on Graffiti. And who else? Gary Kurtz was there, of course. But anyway, we all went out to lunch after the picture. And there's a lot of, you know, sort of, I mean, when we showed it was still very rough looking because of all the black and white shots in the final sequence, and the mix was very rough, and I doubt we'd done much, you know, probably no looping yet, and or very little, and you know, so it was in a rough state from a finishing standpoint, but editorially it was pretty close. But it gave the appearance of being rougher than, you know, it was rougher looking than most films at that point in the edit. There was, you know, some I remember, my recollection is that people were pretty supportive of it, you know, and I think everyone was in agreement. You know, when you show a picture to people who are friends and you ask them to be critical, they want to be helpful, so they'll be critical, you know. That's what they're trying to do. So what you have to do is you have to understand how to accept their criticism. And if everyone picks on a different thing, then you're not really obligated to agree with them. But if everybody seizes on the same problem, then you can be pretty sure you've got a problem and need to address that. You know? So everyone was in agreement that the prologue, the roll up at the beginning, was not right. It was kind of vague and dragged in other elements that had nothing to do with the picture, and the Sith, and you know, Sith, we not relevant to what the picture was about. So we went back to the editing room, and Brian and Jay, and I think Willard, I don't know, the Hikes collaborated, and they rewrote the three paragraphs that precede the picture now. I remember George with, you know, and then Brian is a big tease. He loves to needle people. So he would say, George, what's this stuff about the tractor beam? What's a tractor beam? So he explains, well, the tractor beam is, you know, the thing that pulls them into the Death Star. So Brian says, oh, the big magnet. Oh, yeah, the big magnet. So he was going on at George about, you know, sort of good-natured ribbing, that, you know, the kind of thing he does. And then George sort of got his back up. I guess, you know, we all working so hard and he's sort of tired or whatever. He says, you know, and George, he says, George, what is this, the force? I mean, come on, you know, this is the force be with you. Come on, a force. And George said, well, maybe if your pictures had the force, they'd make more money. And everybody went, ooh. You know, got a little tense, but that was, you know, that was just, Brian's a big kidder, you know. I always consider myself the human pincushion. He would sit behind me and you know, tease me about stuff. I'm very transparent. You know, people can sit behind me and know what I'm thinking without seeing my face. I don't know how they know, but apparently they do.
So there was that screening then. And when after that did you see the final cut? And what was your, you know, did you sit in a cinema and watched it once you were hands off? And what was your opinion of it?
Well, we had a screening for the Fox Board of Directors. About, I don't know, 30, 50 people, you know, the executives and their families. And they came to see it at the mixing studio one day, one morning. And we showed them the picture. And I think we had 9 of the 12 reels mixed. And then we played a temp mix for the last 3 reels. And I think there was a version of an effect shot, not the final effect shot, but a version in each slot so you could see what the intention was. And I remember we got to the end and the lights came on and they sat there like carved statues. I couldn't believe it. No one reacted. I thought, what's with these people, you know? Mm. So then we took the picture up to San Francisco and we previewed it at a theater called the North Point. It's no longer there, I understand. And it's a big theater. And George called Scorsese. Marsha had gone off to work on New York, New York, because Marty's editor had died and he needed help and he wanted Marsha. So Marsha went off to work on New York, New York. And George told me he was bringing her back for the screening for a week. He'd called Marty and said, I need Marsha for a week to make changes after the screening. And I thought, what changes? I mean, we've been working on this. We've been going over this frame by frame for months. What kind of changes, you know? So he said, screenings mean changes. So I said, okay, you know. So we had this screening. It was an absolutely spectacular screening. Singular in my career. It was like body is flying around the room in excitement, you know. We came outside and I said to George, I said, what do you think? He said, well, I guess we'll leave it alone.
For now.
Yeah. And you obviously went on to work on The Empire Strikes Back a couple of years later. I mean, was that a given after the success of Star Wars, or did you have to sort of, you know, compete again to get that gig, given that it was a new director?
No, I came out to L.A. for the Academy Awards, and Gary Kurtz took me to lunch. He said, how'd you like to work on the next one? I said, yeah, I'm in.
Yeah.
And what was it like sort of working with Kirsch, you know, without having, you know, without Marsha Lucas, without Richard Chu, like just sort of, you know, as the sole editor?
Well, it's simpler when you're working alone. You don't have to, you know, when I was working with Marsha and Richard, they were very accomplished. They had, you know, Richard had worked on The Conversation and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Marsha had worked on Taxi Driver and Graffiti. Mm. And, you know, these are, you know, big pictures, much bigger than anything I ever worked on. And so I had to be I was careful to be very courteous and not, you know, we had a meeting at the beginning. We all agreed that we'd show each other our work. And if anyone objected to anything, you know, we would work it out amongst ourselves before we showed it to George.
Mm.
And So working by myself, that step was removed, you know, so it kind of made things simpler. Mm. It gives you more, working alone gives you more freedom to just do what you want.
Mm. Why didn't you end up coming back for Return of the Jedi?
Well, when Empire came out, the Directors Guild fined George because Kirsch's name was at the end of the picture. We designed the credits to mirror exactly what we had done on the first film. Mm-hmm. And I had done this iris out onto directed by in the first film. And George wanted the same thing at the end. So that's what we did. So iris out, directed by Irving Kirshner. And the Directors Guild fined George because the contract says that the director's credit must appear at the head of the film if the producer's name appears there.
Right.
And they considered Lucasfilm Presents to be the producer's name.
Mm-hmm.
So they fined George $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, the Writers Guild fined him the same. So he was furious about this. And he said, on the next picture, and Kirsch was delighted. He thought, he had no problem at all. He said, it's not a problem for me. When my name comes on the screen, everybody bursts into applause. You know? he was thrilled, you know. But the guilds, you know, fined George, and he decided he was not going to hire a DGA director on the next picture. So he went to the UK and he hired Richard Marquand.
Hmm.
And Marquand said to him, I need to be able to have my own cameraman and my own editor.
Hmm.
Of the 1,000 people, whatever, you know, those are the only two that Marquand got to pick.
Hmm.
And, you know, and I have to hand it to him. I mean, loyalty is a good thing, you know, it's a fine thing. And there's too little of it in the industry. And my hat is off to him. I wish I had done the picture. And I think it, you know, anyway, no regrets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From either of the two Star Wars films that you worked on, is there one particular scene that stands out to you as, you know, a favorite scene to have worked on? Or, a particularly satisfying scene to have put together?
There's a couple of things that I look at and say, that was good. You know, I don't know. There's a number of things that give me satisfaction that wouldn't necessarily mean much to anyone else, you know.
Mm.
There's a moment at in the first film where Ben has turned off the tractor beam and they're making their way back to the Millennium Falcon. They're coming from different directions and Vader and Ben are fighting, and it's sort of an interesting sequence because you see the action from different points of view, depending on, and it hadn't been cut. The initial cut wasn't cut in terms of point of view. So it was kind of a mess. It was just confusing. And then I, you know, applying the Palma principles, you know, of storytelling, I put it together based on points of view.
Mm.
So that gives me pleasure when I see it. I think, oh yeah, that works nicely.
Yeah,
these different lines coming together, dovetailing, and the robots crossing at a, you know, in a shot of Luke in the background, and he sees Ben and he cries out, you know, it's just, and there's a big emotional moment, of course, when Ben is struck down, you know. So that's one that gives me pleasure.
Yeah. You mentioned before, you know, your relationship with Brian De Palma, and, you know, it's probably the closest you've come to sort of having a partnership with, you know, the one director, the way that some editors spend, you know, an entire career with one director. In your memoir, yeah, you say that these unions are happy marriages, but you yourself prefer to sleep around. Any reason why that is?
Well, I wanted to work on every kind of film. I wanted to do comedies, I wanted to do dramas, I wanted to do I wanted to do a Bond film. That would have been fun. And then, of course, the Mission Impossible films are sort of like Bond films. So I got to do that. And I wanted to do a Western. I never got to do a Western, but then I did a picture called Hard Rain, which is kind of a Western.
Yeah.
Except instead of a dry, dusty town, it's a town underwater.
Yeah.
Instead of riding horses, they're all in, instead of riding horses, they're all in boats.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do the same thing over and over and over again. And, I can see the attraction of it. I mean, working with somebody you get along with, is very, you know, especially after I had some experiences with, directors whom I didn't see eye to eye with and for whom I have very little respect, and having to be in a subordinate position to people that I don't respect is very difficult. So maybe I should have stayed with Brian. I mean, he and I get along great. He hired me whenever he did a picture on the West Coast, but he was living in New York. I was living in LA, and it just, you know, it was one of those things. But I don't regret it at all. I mean, I worked with Herbert Ross. We did some terrific movies together.
Yeah.
Two of the only movies that ever showed a profit were with Herbert. he gave me 2 points on Footloose, and it, you know, paid off handsomely.
Well played.
Yeah.
Well, people were more generous in those days. Yeah. And then and I worked with John Hughes, which is a remarkable experience. Those pictures that I did with him are, you know, I love seeing them. And they're just two of the funniest movies I've ever seen.
Mm.
They weren't so funny when I was working on them, but they're, you know, it was just a great experience to work with all these different people. I think if I just worked with one person, it would have been a very different kind of experience. It's ironic to me that the editors who become known to the general public are editors who keep working for one director, as opposed to like my friend Billy Weber, who's worked for many different directors, who has extraordinary credits. You can look him up. You know, he's not known to the public, but he's, you know, a great, great editor. It's just, I don't know why it is that people who work for one person become better known.
It's interesting because, like, you know, if you look even just at your filmography, even just looking at the early, you know, the Brian, you know, going from something like Phantom of the Paradise to Star Wars, like, you'd think that, like, I never really thought about what you just said about the fact that you only ever hear of editors who work with the same person, because, like, you would think doing such wildly different films would be something that would make an editor known. Like, if you look at, you know, like you mentioned before, Brian De Palma, it's pure cinema. It's very, like, he kind of draws attention to the fact that, like, I'm making a movie. Like, this is very cinematic. Whereas you look at, like, something like Star Wars, and George has that almost, like, documentary-style approach where you're not meant to think about, you know, there's no split screens or anything like that sort of draw attention to, like, the style.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's fascinating that, like, you could work on such wildly different projects, but from the general public's point of view, it's more, you know, it's someone who works with that same director over and over again that becomes known. It's a weird little paradox.
Yeah, I speak to when I've spoken to Thelma Schoonmaker, she says, "Oh, it's all Marty. It's all Marty." It's okay.
Working with all these directors, some of whom have come up through the editing ranks, did you ever harbor a desire to get into directing yourself at any point?
I did, but then the fever broke. I'm much more suited to editing, I realize. I mean, directors, it's a different job. You have to have a different kind of ability. It doesn't play to my strengths. You have to deal with a lot of very difficult personalities. As an editor, you only have to deal with a couple. But the life of a director is tough. It's, you know, you have to sort of, it's like you're running for office your whole life, unless you hit it really big. You're like one of the three or four directors who work regularly, but most of them are always developing, you know, six or eight different projects in the hope that one will get off the ground. And if they spend 10 years developing something, it's not unusual. So it's not the, I need it to be busy, and I'm happiest when I'm working. And the life of an editor suited me. I could shut the door and focus, and I don't do well in chaotic situations. I'm an orderly person. And, so yeah, I mean, it's natural to aspire to be the boss, you know, but it's really not me.
Mm. Of all the movies you've worked on, is there one that you consider your, you know, your proudest achievement?
No, you know, it's a body of work. I've done over 40 films or whatever. And I mean, there are things about many of them that delight me, and but I've seen them, you know, I can't pick out a single one that's, you know, I love working with music. So that Footloose and Phantom of the Paradise and Ray and the parade sequence in Ferris and mm-hmm. A lot of the montages and Secret of My Success. And, you know, whenever I'm able to cut with music, it makes me happy.
Yeah.
Is that going right the way back to your college days, your first degree then? Yeah, you know, never really left you, that love of music. Do you play any instruments or do you?
No, I'm a music lover. Yeah. Music lover only. I was a timpanist in high school, so that's not, you know, I don't consider myself a musician, but I do have a strong appreciation of music. And, you know, it's interesting. Just recently, I was thinking about myself, you know, under the age of 20. What was I good at? What would I, you know, what could I look back at young me and say, what were you really good at in those days? And I think the one thing that everyone would have agreed on was that I was a really good dancer. My mother always encouraged me as a kid to dance, you know, and mm-hmm. I love to dance, and music moves me. And so when I get to cut film to music, it's sort of like dancing again. You get to be the choreographer. You organize the dance on screen instead of in space, but it's very similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've said that you almost never go back and watch your own films after the fact. Why is that?
Well, after you've seen a film so many times, and you get to the end of it, you know, to quote Jack Nicholson from Terms of Endearment, I'd rather put long needles into my eyes than watch it one more time. You know? It's just, you've seen it so many times, you can't stand to look at it ever again.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe if 20 years go by, actually this last fall, I had a wonderful experience. I was invited to Chicago for a screening of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
If you read the book, you'll understand why I couldn't stand to watch the movie when I got to the end of it. But now it's 1987, something like that. 13, it's like 30, over 30 years later, I get invited to Chicago to watch the picture. And the house, they filled the house, the place is packed. And I watched the movie and I had forgotten a lot of it. And I was able to see it with relatively fresh eyes for the first time with an audience. And it was fantastic. I had the greatest time. The jokes really played. Everyone was laughing their butts off, and it was just a great experience. And I couldn't have had that when the picture first came out, because at that point I couldn't stand to see the picture anymore. You know? So I couldn't have gone and watched it with an audience, because I just couldn't stand it. So it's the Faustian bargain that editors make. They get to be in on the creation, but they can't enjoy the release. You have to give that up. It's like Moses, you can bring them to the promised land, but you can't enter. You can't share in the fun when everyone else is having fun. It's just not fun for you. It's not fun for the editor.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, they're still making Star Wars films, and I believe that J.J. Abrams sort of wanted to get you in and show you a cut of The Force Awakens to get some input. Did that happen?
Yeah, I was honored. He called me in and got my notes, and it was very little to say. The cut was in very good shape at that point. I mentioned a couple of things that worried me a little, and when I saw the finished picture, he had addressed them, so I guess he listened. But I've just discovered The Mandalorian, and I'm amazed at how clever it is and how they've exploited the worlds that were, Tatooine and the various creatures that we set up in the first films.
Mm.
I mean, I thought it was, it's a little uneven. I mean, some of the episodes are not as good as the others, and I'm not finished with it yet. But the effects work is extraordinary, and the creature work and the animation, it's just really good.
Mm-hmm. Like some of the like Solo as well, and The Mandalorian, they all honor these the effects work and the creatures that were in the original trilogy. Do you think the editing kind of pays homage to that as well? Do you think the editing's kind of of a piece?
No, they have the wipes, so they kept that up, so it's sort of the brand, right? It's part of the part of the brand now. editing, editors don't think that way, that, I don't think.
Mm.
They just try to make the picture work.
Yeah. Aside from The Mandalorian, what sort of films are you watching these days? Like, what do you watch now that gives you the same thrill as when you were watching films before you started making them?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm catching up with films that are old classic films I had never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
Some films that I thought that I've seen recently that I thought were wonderful. I saw The Shop on Main Street, Czech film. Fantastic film, beautiful film. I saw Sajid Ray's Pather Panchali, the first of the Apu trilogy. I had never seen that film before. It's a beautiful, beautiful film.
Mm.
There was a film by John Ford that I avoided my whole life because the title made my eyes roll. It's called How Green Was My Valley.
Yeah.
And then I watched it, and I thought it was a wonderful, wonderful film. Just stunning in terms of the staging and the camera work and the composition of the shots and how much life there was on the screen and how much love there is in the story. And it was just. And then the Welsh male chorus. The whole thing was just fantastic. So I'm sort of trying to catch up with old great films that deserve to be classics and, stuff that I just missed somehow.
Yeah. And you obviously, as we've mentioned a few times, you obviously published a memoir a long time ago in a cutting room far, far away. What was, obviously we've barely sort of touched the tip of the iceberg of the stories in that book in this interview, but what was kind of the impetus for you to write that?
I was on location in Vancouver by myself, and this is in 1999. I was alone on the weekends and kind of bored and lonely, and I've been telling these stories on the set for a while to good effect, and I thought to myself, I should really write these stories down. And that's how it started. Mm. And fortunately, or wisely, I made an outline for myself. I thought, what can I write about? What could I write about? This picture, this happened. And then Bernard Herrmann, that was the Benny stories. I have to tell those. And then, so I sort of went through and I made this outline of things I intended to write about. Mm. And And then I chipped away at it for years. I mean, sometimes I put the list away for 2 or 3 years at a time because I'd get busy. But as the years went by, my periods of unemployment grew longer and my periods of employment grew shorter. I spent more and more time working on the book till I finished the first draft in 2017. I got a literary agent in 2018, kept editing the book, and we sold it in the fall of 2018, and then kept editing the book, and then finished the edit, finished the final version almost a year ago now.
And in the process of putting the book together, you know, you've obviously had to throw your mind back into the way your career's gone, and as a kind of potted history of Paul Hirsch, did you glean anything profound from looking back at your career in that way? Have you seen any patterns emerge?
Well, I think I pissed off a lot of directors.
That's profound.
That's a good realization to come to.
I have no regrets though.
And what's next for you? Like, are there any sort of upcoming projects that you're at liberty to talk about?
The future? Is there such a thing as the future?
Exactly.
Feels that way.
That's true. We really need to stop asking people that because nobody knows at the moment what's going to happen in the future. Look, Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. Where can people grab a copy of the book?
Well, it's on Amazon. It's on the Barnes & Noble website as well. It's on the website of the publisher, Chicago Review Press. But Amazon, I suppose, is probably the easiest one. There's an audio version on Audible as well. And it's on Kindle. You can get it on Kindle or hardcover.
So there you go, guys. That's where you can pick up a copy of the book. If you're looking for us on social media, we're very easy to find. We are, you know, you can find us obviously at forcematerial.com. We are at Force Material on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, mostly Twitter. And if you want to leave us a 5-star review for this podcast, if you've enjoyed this conversation with Paul, look, we're certainly not going to stop you from doing that. Feel free to go and do that on whatever your podcast platform of choice is. And yeah, if you've enjoyed the conversation, like, make sure, you know, you share it with your friends, and that'll that sort of stuff helps the podcast. I'm Rowan Williams.
I'm Baz McAllister.
I'm Paul Hirsch.
And you've just taken your first step into a larger world.